Hello and welcome to another episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock'n'Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets and digital currencies, and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I am co-host Michael Blaschke, and today it is time for another book review. Today we dive into a really refreshing book, in particular for our institutional audience. It's called A Thousand Times As Much Money As Now, respectively, Tausendmal So Viel Geld Wie Jetzt for our German-speaking listeners. The book really, from my perspective, stands apart from typical crypto literature by focusing on ordinary individuals rather than industry luminaries that we so often talk about. This sociological approach examines cryptocurrency not just as a financial instrument, but as a social phenomenon that has created new pathways to wealth while simultaneously highlighting existing societal fault lines. Now, Juan, welcome to the show. Do you agree with my initial assessment of the book?
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I mean, roughly speaking, yeah, I think it's maybe important to mention that although it has this sociological background in the sense that it's based on interviews I had with a lot of retail investors, there's also this element of fiction. And it's not just about trying to sort of provide anonymity to all the people I've spoke to, but rather than really distorting the material I was working with, because I was not interested in just a sociological paper, but I was trying to bridge the gap between the two sort of like jobs I have with this, which is the sociology on the one side and as a fiction writer on the other side. And sort of the book tries to bridge that gap by having a very broad material in terms of interviews and ethnographical material, and then working with it, but with fictional and literary methods.
Yeah, and this is what makes your book so hard to classify, which in my perspective is a feature, not a bug. So on the one hand, there is empirical data. I mean, you spoke to those few crypto bros that really made it, that really got rich by means of crypto assets. But on the other hand, there's a fictional element in that you recombined, revised, mixed their stories and condensed their stories and worldviews in four archetypes, if you will, or prototypical retail investors and their lives.
Sure. And I think, I mean, that's sure, we're going to talk about it. There are other types you can derive from my data. So, I mean, there's four portraits or four men who got pretty wealthy off of crypto, to some extent at least, who started with some very small capital. But beyond these four archetypes, there are a bunch of other, I would define as sort of like, yeah, different types of retail investors.
Yeah, before we deep dive into the very discussion, we of course need to introduce you yourself properly too. So today I am joined by the book's very author, Juan. If I got it right, you're a sociologist by training. You even got a PhD in sociology. So you're the one to introduce us and our institutional audience to, yeah, the very lives and worldview of the crypto pros that got rich. But you are a renowned author too. In my opinion, you represent a compelling voice in the contemporary cryptocurrency discourse, not as a technologist or financial analyst, as there are so many, but as a sociologist examining the human stories behind the creation of digital wealth. Yeah, you were born in 1989, and with that you bring a generational perspective to a phenomenon that has defined much of the experience that the millennials have in finance. Yeah, you have an award-winning background in sociology, and exactly this sociological background provides the analytical framework necessary to dissect the social implications of crypto wealth, in my perspective. And again, here, Juan, do you entirely agree with my interpretation of your authoring career, or would you add something?
No, I'm kind of like, it's just maybe interesting to know that I'm with one foot leaving sociology behind and working more towards the arts, to say. But yeah, sociology and empirical research will always be sort of like part. It is, and also it's maybe like interesting to note for people who might be interested in the stuff I do beyond this book about crypto retail investors, is that all of my novels also have this underlying current of a sociological interest. So I didn't study sociology just because I needed a job. It's directly intertwined with my interest in storytelling and sort of like, yeah, posing certain questions to the world.
Yeah, but let's face it. I mean, your training never leaves you entirely. I think you will always be, you will always have a sociological perspective on whatever you do, I guess.
For better or worse, yeah.
Alrighty. So today we target three goals. First and foremost, of course, we're going to review your book, in particular, why you wrote it, why you published it this year, the content or what can be found in there, and particularly how you did it. So, for example, how did you find rich crypto retail investors? I wouldn't even know where to start. But also, we're going to look on the micro level and promote the worldview of exactly these interviewed individual crypto bros and what we can learn from their worldviews. And then thirdly, and ultimately, we move on to the meso level. And you see, I'm already adopting sociological terms here, I guess. And yeah, try to understand the role of institutions in the lives and the worldviews of your interviews. I expect a pretty harsh view in that they have a more negative perception of banks and CeFi and TradFi organizations, but you know better than I do. Alrighty, with that, let's start. Let's take a look on the why, the book's rationale and timing. So, Juan, you chose to examine cryptocurrency wealth through a sociological lens rather than a financial or technological one. So what drove you to approach this topic as a social scientist rather than simply as an economist or a market analyst?
Totally, yeah. There are a couple of things that I always found interesting about the crypto space and its participants, both sort of like at the meso level, the people who are actually pump out protocols and the people who are investing into it and believing in it. One is that from the get-go, it has always been tied sort of like to an ideological project, or it has been framed as an ideological project, which is now like 15 years after Bitcoin seems obvious, but it's not obvious if you look at other asset classes. Like most asset classes don't want to change the world. They want to sort of like have it stay more or less the same with some progression in terms of production or whatever or value. But crypto always have, we can discuss if that's relevant or not for the products or for the protocols, but has been always been tied to this idea of disruption and change. That's what sort of like tickles me as a writer, as a storyteller, and also as a sociologist. This idea of it being more than just an industry, but the industry itself, or it's describing themselves as sort of like a movement. Again, we can discuss if that's actually the case and fits the definition of a social movement, but the self-description, the self-narrative is that, or has been that for a long time. And it's interesting to see how it's getting more and more irrelevant. So that got me interested into the space. What my editors sort of like pushed a lot is the idea of having ordinary people doing this leap towards ginormous wealth. But that's just sort of like an opening in terms of storytelling. I'm actually more interested in what got them into sort of like investing in crypto as an ordinary person rather than how it affected and changed their life becoming this wealthy. It's a bunch of things that got me interested, but it's more than anything, the disruptive narrative of crypto. And then in terms of why I chose this sociological approach and why the book is more interested in the human side and not in the technical side, first of all, because there's already, as you said, a bunch of literature exploring the technical side and the institutionalist side. And I wanted to highlight something and highlight persons who are not very visible. Like some of them might have an internet persona, but all these people I've spoke to, and the people I was interested most in were people that were under the radar. Well, very wealthy, but sort of like maintaining their lifestyle as if they hadn't, I don't know, $50 million in crypto assets laying around. So I felt like there was more to explore and more to discover than having it on the sort of like focusing the technical and financial aspect of it.
Super interesting. I always wondered when reading the book, how did you find these guys?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not so easy to find individuals that get rich via crypto investments, but remain under the radar. I mean, how did you refer to them as the sleepers, in that they don't brag with their riches?
Yep.
They don't buy the Gucci clothing, but really keep under the radar. How did you find them?
It's a tough sell because, as you said, the ones who brag with their wealth are easy to find. And I felt like their stories are being told by themselves all the time. Like, I got nothing and I invested in this and that and you should too and blah, blah, blah. All of this narrative of from rags to riches has been told a million times. They're so easy to find. They're so easy to come by sort of as in terms of data, in terms of acquiring them as interview partners. It's much harder to find something where you have very, very, very little sort of like cues. And it's basically what I used to get to know more people was sometimes I would write people on Reddit that I felt like their sort of like posts were interesting, but not bragging. I felt like these people are very invested into it. And then sometimes these conversations got to a point and when I then sort of like pushed for an interview, they rejected it or sometimes they didn't. But what I found the most helpful is that they're sort of like, they know each other to some extent. Like very often I'd use this snowball principle where like one lead leads to the other lead. In the end, the persons that ended up being in the book, like these four characters, they don't know each other, but I certainly got from one point to another by asking, hey, you should talk to this guy. You should talk to this guy. So really much relying on interpersonal connections to get these people to know and to get these people to talk, right? Because as I said, I mean, these are not people who brag with their money, but which does mean that they're not interested in talking about it. They're just very maybe shy and reluctant to open up to a completely stranger. That was definitely like in terms of getting the data and getting to talk to these people is opening, getting them to open up was by far the hardest part.
Yeah, so beyond the mere why, it's also interesting always to understand why now. So why did you publish the book this year, I think? Yeah, the timing is, from my perspective, fascinating because we're seeing institutional adoption accelerate ever more while retail investors still often struggle. So retail investors beyond the crypto bubble, of course. So why do you feel this was the right moment to tell these particular stories?
It's a good question. I mean, to some extent, it's not in my control to when. I mean, I can argue with the editor to when more or less we can publish the book. I felt like, I mean, you could say there was this 15 years of white paper anniversary that could be sort of like something to latch on to in terms of marketing of the book. But I feel like it's interesting from a point of view to, as you said, like our generation, I'm born in 89, they've been exposed to this to the possibilities of investing in crypto for so long. To some extent, it's not in my control to when the book gets published. That's part of the publisher's job. Honestly, I think it would be also interesting to have published it in a sort of like a bull run of 2021. It would have a different vibe to it. And I'm sure the data I would have gathered would be very, very different. The data that I've now gathered was from the bull run of 21 to the bear market afterwards. So you have a very diverse experience that these players have, like from getting a lot of wealth increase overnight and to losing all or most of it in a couple of weeks. To some extent, it was luck that I did my research in that time frame and I didn't just do it maybe during Corona and a bit before it where we'd have only bull market. But yeah, so sometimes it's just pure luck.
Yeah, I mean, no sweat, Juan, if the more pragmatic reason is that you were just approached by the publisher, that is S. Fisher, by the way,
yeah.
Then that's it. I mean, there's no need to invent a reason. Sometimes it's just when interest or demand in the market appears. So whenever some publisher is interested most, then it happens.
Yeah, sure. I shouldn't do that. Well, I mean, I just did what you typically do as an author. You do a lot of, like a literary author, a lot of mental gymnastics to sort of like not talk about money. Right? Because there's this tradition or this culture of art being a thing that is almost disgusted by money. And I just fell into my own trap that I should know better because I've read Pierre Bourdieu, all of his work in terms of the field of literary and all of these mythological constraints that authors and any other form of artists carry around with them.
Yeah, in particular, I mean, talking about the money aspect of publishing, I found it quite charming that you exposed yourself and just honestly made public that you lost around 2,000 euros in crypto trading, which must have been tough. Yeah, losing a substantial amount of money and talking to individuals that made millions and millions with it.
The inequality thing is not something that bugs me. I mean, you'd lose your fucking mind if you're constantly bothered by the world being unequal. It is all the time, and it's not fair, and we're not living in a meritocratical system, at least not a fully one, not even close. But what really what was really tiresome was how they would always argue, at least the ones that have this survivor bias, how easy it is, right? So that's very, very tiresome. Like, if the narrator of the book tries to follow their recommendations in terms of investment, and it always fails them. And by the way, it's also important to note, the narrator, which is basically me, not only sort of like talks openly about how much he loses, but he also tries to not take the perspective I was just mentioning, sort of like an outsider's perspective that's not interested in money and doesn't care about money. Basically, I tell you in the book how much I made from the book, like selling it to the publisher, right? So it's part of the trying to be as transparent as possible and not trying to have this bird's eye view on them, but be really like both feet on the ground in terms of also the narrative perspective.
All right. With that, let's move to the what. So the content deep dive, really. So in the book, you deliberately chose to profile quote unquote ordinary men.
Yeah.
Than crypto celebrities or industry insiders. What criteria did you use to identify these individuals, and what made their stories representative of broader trends?
I mean, the representation is always, I mean, if I try to make a generalization of whatever I was gathering in terms of data, you'd always, it's very easy to criticize. I mean, we're talking about, depends on how you count it, but it's maybe 20, 25 interviews. I don't consider it like a traditional sociological research. It doesn't have the same methodological constraints I would usually sort of like put myself under. In terms of direction of the research, it did a turn when I realized I wasn't interested in these typical, I live now in Dubai and show off my wealth kind of guys. So I stopped following all those sort of like paths and all the contacts I had to these kind of people, and started following people who went, as I mentioned, right, usually I got sort of like in contact with them via other people, where I felt like these people, I mean, that's why it's so important to meet them, because I wanted to see if it's true what they're talking about. If the car they were mentioning in chat, for example, yeah, I drive this old shitty car and I still live in this fucked up apartment, if that's true, or if that's just sort of like another branding of themselves, instead of bragging with wealth and fancy cars, you brag with humility, right? And sometimes sort of like I was there, it was more the case that what they were really like ordinary people, that you very rapidly get an idea to where people coming from. When they then maybe in chat they didn't mention that their parents had a background in investment, or that they worked priorly in Frankfurt or New York or whatever, then sort of like it was not the sort of like contact I was using for, but then like in terms of when they start telling you that their parents were just ordinary teachers or whatever, and you get the really whole picture of a biography of a person, and you feel like it checks all the boxes to being like middle class. The initial investment they had to get into the space wasn't like six figures. And then like I was like generally trying to categorize them as like ordinary men.
I wonder what distinguishes your population from those who don't get rich with crypto. So how did these individuals' backgrounds, be it their education, their social networks, their professional environments, influence their ability to recognize and act on the opportunities of cryptocurrencies at the time? I mean, are they smarter? Are they more risk prone?
Mm-hmm. I mean, they definitely would like to believe that they're smarter, but that's just survivor's bias kicking in, right? I mean, in terms of, they're very different, like from the 25 people I've talked to, obviously they're all different. They all have their different backgrounds, but they have some similarities in terms of what they've been through and what they believe in. And one core experience or core realization basically all of them have and this ties directly to their middle class background, is realizing that the promises that were made to sort of like the boomer generation in terms of how you could live as an employee and how you could finance maybe like these traditional milestones of a middle class family, like buying your own house, having a car, going on holidays 2 times a year, whatever, that these were out of reach or getting consistently more out of reach. Like if you look at, so in a sense, they all had this realization that they're very limited in terms of reaching those goals that they had, that maybe their parents had or their grandparents had, which is like, it's very, it's almost like a meme, like me at 30 versus my parents at 30 meme type of shit. That was sort of like the emotional gateway to get them into other assets in general, and particularly into speculative assets like crypto. And if they're smarter or not, I mean, they surely always preach and talk about how much they did their research, right? Their due diligence research. But I'm sure most people do that to some extent, because their research is, in some cases, they do the extra mile. For example, I have one character that is interested, who invested in Chainlink, and very early on, in order to sort of like prove if the company was real, if it actually existed, if there were, or is it just maybe like a, I don't know, like a drywall that would fall over if you just touch it. He made like fake LinkedIn accounts, called the company up, asked questions, pretend to be a journalist and all kinds of shit. So I really get to an idea of the realness of the materiality of the company, right? But at some point, all of them have to believe. Like you can do as much research as you want. You can have as much insight. Not insight, but maybe knowledge in terms of how the technology works. At some point, you just have to believe. And then it's just, it has nothing to do with intelligence or smart decisions. It just has to be with do with luck.
Yeah, and the risk appetite. The higher the risk appetite, the earlier you stop the education investigation.
Yes,
or research.
100%, yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So now, better understanding whom you actually interviewed, it must be super interesting to observe how a person from a middle class background suddenly gets super rich. Yeah. So what psychological patterns did you observe among your interviewees who experienced sudden wealth through cryptocurrencies? How did they rationalize their success? As skill, as luck, or something else? I guess it was predominantly skill, that is the survivor's bias.
For them, it was skill. But in terms of what psychological impact that had, it's very interesting to see that for the majority of people, money is a constraint in the sense that it sort of like limits of how you can live your life, right? So you have a very limited scope of the decisions you can take. Might seem like a lot because you can move there, you could do a different job. But in terms of, you can't do everything. You can't just try out, hey, maybe I might want to live 4 years in Bahamas or whatever to find out if I'm interested in coconut planting. You could do it, but it's probably not a very wise choice. But these people get tossed into a life where they can really just do whatever the fuck they want. Your intuition would be, that's great. I mean, they're probably having a blast and just trying out different things all the time. But initially, a lot of these guys fell into, at least for my population, for my sample, fell into sort of like a crisis because they didn't know what they were actually looking for with the money, since all the my sample was not interested in buffing up their lifestyle from 10 to 100, sort of like maybe like go out to eat more, but basically, that's it. And they're just accumulating money, and didn't have any purpose for it. So they started this inner journey and trying to find out what they're actually doing with money. And then it gets, these were the interviews who got most emotional, right? For example, there's the first story, the first chapter of the book. It's about a guy who, even though he's at the moment, I met him first for the first time, was making a lot of money, seemingly, a lot of yield, was still working as a gardener on a cemetery, right? And he always told me, I don't know what I'm actually planning with to do with the money. And he was like so desperate to find a purpose, but he was looking to buy entire like landscapes, like entire forests in Indonesia, entire forests in Scotland, just to repopulate. He didn't know what to do with it. And then it got to sometimes you have these moments where the interview gets so personal that he started talking about his father and how this guy only showed love to his kids, but through the means of money, right? But these are sort of like very individual stories that can't be generalized for my whole sample. But it's just interesting because you'd expect them to be sort of this moment of liberation. First, there comes a moment in crisis, I'd say, in most cases.
Yeah, I'm still wondering. I mean, we are still talking rather abstractly about the individuals, the sociological perspective. Can you give us some intuition about the extreme end of interviews with an example of where they wasted money and then probably a surprise on the other end where one of your interviewees was really rational and sober, like investing properly without wasting any money? Can you give us some snippets or insights to get more meat on the bone and to become more specific?
What do you mean? You mean you want me to be more specific about their investment strategies?
No, about their behavior. So, I mean, all of a sudden you get rich, and I could imagine you had some crazy guys that then just overspend.
Yeah.
Like one example that resonated with me was like buying a massive set of AirPods and just putting them in the room, because whenever you lose one, you've got one. I would never do that because it's just irrational.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for these extreme examples of waste, but then was there also an individual that used the money really wisely in terms of reinvesting, thinking about old age, buying retail, investing in a diversified way?
There's all kinds of, I mean, there's a very broad spectrum from, as you mentioned, people throwing the money out of the window, either by having diversifying into whatever project they could find on the internet, or spending it on random stuff like, I don't know, buying 15 AirPods Pros just because they know they're prone to lose them, so they'd rather have just a bunch of them laying around and so they don't have to worry about it. So you'd have these very like irrational actors that still would sort of like try to rationalize and sell you everything they do as very rational. And not erratic and not nonsensical. And then you'd have, and these are interestingly, not a lot of the people I talk to that try to sort of like materialize and invest it in the long-term future. Maybe try to get cash out to some extent and invest in stocks or buy a house. Most of these people are so convinced, right, that they don't cash out because they think it's going to be adopted anyway. Like everyone has their story because they have a currency or a token that is close to their heart. And I think it's obvious that, I don't know, Quant or Chainlink or, I don't know, Ohm, to mention just a bunch, is going to be massively adopted. So why would I sell? It's like they always mention it as like one sort of like comparison they make. It's like selling Amazon stocks while they were getting big selling books, right? So there are some people who materialize their gains, but most are just full in, all in, and continue to either reinvest in other projects or just holding their stuff.
Okay, so there is at least a small subset that never sold or never, or only partially sold. So strictly speaking, they are still imperfectly invested in that they are not diversified. So it's not like they
100%.
Have some money in ETFs, some in some crypto assets, but they're just one or a few tokens and they wait. So
because it's being
there
all
is a
overwritten.
Chance they are no longer.
It's being all over. So like the moment of victory, like the survivor bias overrides everything. Like if you made 100x on your investment 2 years ago, why would you doubt your ability of your own assessment in terms of where this token or this coin or whatever is going, right? So they're very irrational by nature of their sort of like massive gains that they experience. So they're like, and to the people who have, like not all the people I interviewed had 100x or 50x gains. Notably, people who had smaller gains tend to be more rational and think, oh, maybe I should diversify and pull something over to ETFs or whatever. But these people had made big gains on maybe just one single specific token. They're they're convinced of the token and themselves that they didn't really consider diversifying.
Yeah, so are there, I mean, you said you no longer have contact to any of them? Are you aware of any of them through never actually realizing their wins, no longer being rich because the tokens just went down?
Actually, two. One is in the book, the other one isn't. Just the last couple of weeks, I spoke to a couple of my interviewees, and one actually has to pay back. He did some very stupid trades on a project called Olympus DAO, which turned out to be a scam. He wouldn't say so, but it is. He now has to pay back taxes, I think more than 1 or 2 million. And he lost basically all of his wealth because he invested. He didn't have any sort of like safe bet. High on that rush of seeing the number go up, right? So yeah, he's in big, big trouble. And another one I'm still sort of in contact with, he's doing fine. And interestingly, he's also thinking about exiting to some extent. And it's interesting how he framed it. He says he still has the belief that it's predictable, right? So he has bought this like, I don't know, it's an analytical tool that costs you like 10,000 euros a year to run. Do all sorts of analytical stuff on the markets. And he says, it's pretty clear that I'm going to sell in 7 years, as if it were sort of like clear as daylight what's going to happen, as if he could predict the future. He's so convinced by it. There's no single doubt in his mind that he will exit in, I think it was April or something. He was tossing out numbers, going to XXX and this and blah, blah, blah. So he would be an example of someone who's also trying to leave now so far hasn't lost anything. But they're both extremes are very present in the sample.
Yeah. Yeah, super interesting. Yeah, there's a lot to learn from your interviewees. Interview is such an anonymous word. I mean, you are most likely aware of the ups and downs that your acquaintances or interviewees went through. So there's certainly a human side to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's some struggle more with it, some struggle less. I mean, for example, the guy who's trying to cash out of this big token, and if he really can cash out, he's like nine figures type of rich, and he's still sort of like regretting not having selling earlier when the token was even a bit higher. So he still thinks every single fucking day about his investment. It's not something he has on the side like you would have making a stock portfolio. Or you maybe get, sometimes you get nervous, there's like a crash, but you think long term. These guys are constantly watching charts go up and down, and they're very sort of like emotionally attached to it.
Yeah, so Juan, by now we did review the book to some extent. We now also understood kind of, and now switching to the sociological language, the micro level. So these individual worldviews, their decision making. Of course, now we also want to understand what your friends, interviews, acquaintances, whatever word you prefer, what they think about the institutions in the space. I mean, BFRR is an institutional blockchain podcast, and sure. I am totally sure that to some extent you covered the role of institutions too. So how did existing institutions like banks or CeFi, TradFi players play a role in the interviews? What's the perception of these institutions
It depends on the type. You could map out, like maybe I try to map out eight types. And by far the most predominant type is what I would call the libertarian reformer, right? So their core motivation, if you take it as a type, obviously these types are overlapping all the time. But if you take it as a raw ideal type in the sense of Max Weber, you'd have their core motivation being the rejection of state institutions, central banks, and fiat money. Right. So with the classical libertarian background, sometimes with a sprinkle of techno anarchists. And so you could like they what be a typical quote of these guys with like the Fed is inflating away our savings with crypto. Like, take back control of my money and all that kind of stuff. Right. And this is I'd say by far the most reoccurring ideological take on crypto. Right. Sort of this libertarian. And so these people would not just have a very critical view on state institutions, But also on private institutions getting too big, which doesn't mean that there you'd have in this type only like Bitcoin maxis, but a general sense of focusing on sort of like the individual and their responsibility to work in a space. Is the general behind all of this, like in a classical libertarian sense, a fragmentation of society? That's sort of like their main framework in which they think about life in general or the world in general. And you could go this through all the types and different types would have a different take on different institutions. Like some might even want more regulation because they may maybe like sort of like a more pragmatic retail investor, and others would sort of like reject all kinds of institutions like the libertarian reformer, and some don't care.
Juan, you alluded to this typology of at least eight types, but I mean, they're not in the book. Did you publish this somewhere?
No, I'm working on it, actually. I'm currently a journalist in residence in Darmstadt for 1 month, and I'm going through all of my data again, I mean, with the help of an LLM. Otherwise, I'd lose my fucking mind to read again 1,200 pages of transcripts. And I'm trying to work on an article who sort of like sips through the data and the interviews and tries to present them in a more journalistic, more systematic way that gets rid of all the fictional elements. And these eight types are sort of what I'm starting at. Might get more, might get less. But yeah, that's something I'm working on currently and try to publish by the end of the month.
Yeah, so Juan, I have a competing typology to offer, and I'm interested to understand what you think about it. So in particular in the space, in the crypto community, a typology often adopted is there are the maximalists, of course. Mm-hmm. They pretty much map to the libertarian forks you just referred to. Mm-hmm. And then there are the minimalists. There's also this, it was introduced by the book Die Orangene Pille, mm-hmm. Which you most likely know, like you carefully approach it with a minimalist view. And then the third type would be the realist. I would describe myself as a realist. I just understand the technological affordances, the financial opportunities, carefully investigate. If I'm convinced, I invest. If not, I investigate other opportunities and use cases. Yeah. So do you buy this typology? And if not, why do you offer eight types then?
I mean, because I generally would agree that you could work with a three-type typology. But I think the first type you've mentioned is more diverse. I'd agree that the rational ones is sort of like
that is maximalist. The maximalist, so there's more nuance in the maximalist.
Yeah, because the maximalist, that's what I find so interesting about crypto from the retail perspective. They project so much on it. It's, I mean, we're talking about a very, very boring technology at the end of the day, right? I mean, what comes out of it is a different thing, but they can project so much to like societal change and philosophical value onto the blockchain, that I would argue that the maximalists, like these real enthusiasts, should be sort of like divided into more types. For example, I wouldn't say the libertarian reformer is the same as what I would call the techno-optimist, right? So which their core motivation being like this very deep belief in innovation and the transformative power of technology, maybe like root it more in this transhumanism philosophical roots. Or for example, a third type would be, I would call them like this community believer. Or an interesting type that got me interested, that got me into this field as well, what I would call the pop financial emancipator. And this is not limited to crypto. If you look, for example, at the meme stocks like GME, these are people who aspire for upward mobility through investing, you know, despite limited capital. And they have this bottom-up meritocracy, this Reddit-style financial activism, if you will. And these are all people who deeply believe in the thing. They're maximalists in the sense that they're all in, but they're not the same. You can't just toss them all in the same bucket and say they're more or less all just maxis. They're maxis in the sense that, yeah, they believe in the technology and they believe it's going to go up, but they map different ideologies onto it and different motivations onto it.
Yeah, definitely see value in your specification of the maximalist type, because whenever I attend the maximalist events, you really see those different streams here. Some approach it from a philosophical perspective, some from a technological, economical, and yeah, they really approach, even though they are all together maximalist, they really approach the rabbit hole entirely from a different angle. Some are in for number go up, some are in for understanding new use cases for blockchain. Yeah. So I'm pushing this typology topic that much because, I mean, we're still on the meso level, still the organizational, institutional perspective. Wouldn't it be the most effective approach in really understanding which of these types you approach with your offering? So if you're offering crypto custody, for example, for retail investors, you would need a nuanced marketing approach in that you ask yourself, do I target the number go up retail investors that want to get rich? Do I approach the techno-optimists that see blockchain or Bitcoin as a liberating technology? This is what I sometimes miss in the institution's perspective. For them, it's just retail investors.
Yeah. Right. I mean, if you sit on the institutional side, studying the beliefs, the values of retail, I feel like this is just a small sample, but still, it's more than a soft add-on, right? It has some practical edge, I feel like. Because in crypto, these narratives become like orderful, like they're usually fast. So you have to be very smart about how you approach them. It depends on the institutions we're talking about. It might be of great value to know who's on the other receiving end, because there is a huge sort of like persistent gap between distortion into what is talked about on an institutional level and what is talked on the floor, right? The only question I would have to you guys, because I was listening to a bunch of your episodes, what is your take or your perspective on retail? Is it something that just goes by and it doesn't really matter because retail will adopt? Or sort of like, what is your take as institutionally interested players?
I mean, I can only speak for myself. My take is that the industry lives and dies with broad adoption by retail investors.
Yeah.
I mean, the bootstrapped network of Bitcoin has reached a maturity that is fascinating and is proof of survivability of the technology. But then when you go further and talk about the institutional use cases of blockchain, like the tokenization of assets.
Yeah.
And 24/7 worldwide settlement of these tokenized assets. I think these efficiencies and these new business models will only survive if we observe broad global institutional adoptions. A good example is stablecoins.
Mm-hmm.
They really solved a problem in developing countries in which citizens seek exposure to US dollar. That's basically the case for USDT, US dollar Tether, which through that made it to number one stablecoin. Yeah. So, and this is because of broad retail adoption. Yeah. So the institutions can explore as many use cases as they want. If there is none among them that really targets the rest of the world or the other 90%, we can stop investigating.
The question remains if, since it's, I mean, it has a sort of a big microphone in terms of assets, the crypto market, I feel like, but it's still relatively small in terms of all the assets worldwide. And the question, since there's so many people left to integrate and to onboard, do these initial sort of like, does this initial population of the first 10 years really matter? I mean, they matter in the sense that all they have a lot of wealth, and where wealth is, there's power. But isn't it possible to sort of like to gather confidence within the rest of the population that's, in terms of a market, in terms of a communication, that's different to what is too interesting to the sort of like the early adopters, if you will, right? So for example, I mean, if you have someone who's saying crypto for me is more than just making money, it's sort of like part of my core values of sovereignty, fairness, and belonging. And the institutional take would be to, I'm here to deliver risk-adjusted returns with constraints. Then the effect is that maybe retail tolerates, I don't know, clunky UI if it fits the story, and institutions tolerate narrative only if it fits the model. So you'd have these sort of like conflicts all the time, but you guys said, okay, we do these people apart and build up sort of like a second wave of adoption that has always will be overlapping, but it's not so sort of like, it doesn't get too blocked by trying to convince and get and cater to the early adopters.
Yeah, so one thing is the type of retail investor, and if we all know maximalists, your book promotes the prototypes or hardcore maximalists that even didn't sell at a later point, because even after some price losses, they kept believing. But yeah, the first thing is to understand these different types of retail investors. And I think your book is exactly one of them, or some of these maximalists. But the second step then, if I understand you correctly, is for the institutions out there targeting these other 90% in the market, understanding the distribution of these types. Yeah. So are there more minimalists? Are there more realists? Are there more techno-optimists as one subtype of the maximalists? Are there more get-rich-quick individuals? And this then determines the marketing, the communications, and the design of products and services. And I think there is really a big white spot in the institutional landscape. I think for institutions, it's still just retail investors.
100%. Because there, it's to some extent, these early adopters are very special type of people, as most of us probably listening to these podcasts know, right? They're not the everyday typical European or Indian or whatever middle class guy. They're not risk averse. They don't get sort of like scared out a company only communicating in meme, sort of like in terms of memes and jokes and irony. So these are people who have just very little to do with the general public that has a lot of capital left over, like this old TradFi money, maybe, if you will. So, and it, I mean, the players are, in terms of the corporate side, already know this, right? That you have to get rid to some extent of this old culture, in the sense that they're trying to rebrand it as Web 3.0 instead of crypto, because they know it's so burned as a term for the rest of the people you're trying to onboard. So yeah, I'd agree with you that you'd have to some extent, maybe limit your dependence on trying to convince these already established actors in onboarding them, because they're onboard and they're so fixated on what they believe in that it's hard to maybe sort of like lose their skeptical take on regulators, rating agencies, which is maybe just exactly that what the other 90% need, right? This focus on regulations is a license to operate, qualified custodies, auditors are non-negotiable, and stuff, et cetera, et cetera.
So Juan, to close our institutional perspective, this is your opportunity to pitch why a banker or an asset manager should read this book.
It's a good question. It's, first of all, it's an interesting question, because usually, like, I feel like the people who've read the book and the people who I've sort of like invite me to talks and stuff are a very different breed from you guys, right? These are people who have not been in, who have made basically the rest of the 90% who still need to be convinced, or they lack basic knowledge about cryptocurrencies. So for someone who has an understanding of it, it might be interesting sort of like to see how hard these retail people believe in what they're doing, right? That what they do is not something they're willing to give up easily. They have to some extent, they're pragmatic and they will sort of like switch their narrative if it fits them, but they're very much convinced of what they do. So trying to understand, then you have to consider that these people, especially the ones who made a fortune from it, are not going to get, you're really going to have a hard time convincing them if it doesn't fit their narrative.
So what you're saying is that if a bank or asset manager appears too prudential, too top-down, seeking to convince any retail investor, that might go wrong, because if I understand you correctly, these retail investors have an established worldview and won't be taught by a bank or an asset manager of why they should invest or custody at their place.
Exactly, because that's what they got into it. Sort of like they always pitch this, or they very much focus on this freedom that they got. And this freedom isn't just financial freedom, it's freedom of thought. Like they consider themselves 100% atomized individuals, and they're not going to get sort of like they are the ones doing all of the explaining. Like to some point, this interview, at some point you unlock them and they really think, they really have this perspectives on themselves that there's very little they can learn. Right.
Yeah, sure. Juan, with that, let's close our conversation. Thank you so much for writing a book that not only sheds light on a world that is really unknown by many, not only by the institutions, but really to sheds light on a world unknown to most. My big hope is that the individuals you interviewed really are as rich as they pretend. I bet you did your quality checks and assessments, because I know individuals that just pretend to be rich but aren't, or lost their money. I really also like the book because it doesn't fit in any category. It's neither a scientific article, as it lacks the rigor needed to be published, but it's also not simply nonfiction. So it's neither fiction nor pure nonfiction. That's a quality in itself that not many books offer. So from my end, you really got a reading recommendation. And you find the link to the book in the show notes. And if you want to learn more about the world of those few retail investors that, at least at the time of the interview, made it to crypto riches, then that is your book. With that, thanks for listening to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll. Thanks, Juan, for your takes and insights and for the book. Connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn, and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English. For details, consult the show notes. And Juan, this is also my invitation to you to join this community. There might be the one or other question about you, your interviews, and the book, but of course, up to you.
I will.
Excellent. And to our listeners, visit our website for more detailed analysis and detailed show notes. Make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat, and Rock'n'Roll wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next week again when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is BFRR bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks for listening.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.